Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 35, Lessons in Magical Manipulation, where we will be talking with Mark Anthony Lewis about the power of rhetoric in the Harry Potter series. For joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2. My co-host today is Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing and author of several Harry Potter essays. Emily, you are probably, like me, trying to figure out how to do some distance learning with what were face-to-face classes since the Ohio governor's order about that. How are you handling the situation?
Well, you know, it's I'm just trying to remind myself it's not unlike Hogwarts under the reign of Dolores Umbridge.
Oh my.
Student organizations, societies, teams, groups, and clubs are henceforth disbanded. All Quidditch matches are hereby canceled. Boys and girls are not permitted to be within 8 inches of each other. 6 feet. I mean, 6 feet. That's what I meant.
Right.
Yes, I'm distance learning. I'm distance teaching. I'm distance, you know, parenting right now, apparently. I was just happy that I was able to claim in my house a room with a door for today's episode.
Very important.
Because that's a real privilege in my house, which is not that big, full of people who need to work and go to school.
So. Yes. We're having a lot of togetherness in our house, which is not always the best thing, I would say. We like, you know, what Khalil Gibran says, and let there be spaces in your togetherness. I always sort of think we should be doing more of that just within our own house right now. And I imagine that we have some listeners who are also dealing with some of this. And I hope that our episode here, which is posting in April, I hope that our episode will provide people a little oasis in our discussion of books that we love very much, and they can provide us some guidance and also like a little break.
Yeah. I love it.
Our guest, Mark Anthony Lewis, is also experiencing this. And so let me introduce him to our listeners and we'll hear how he's doing. Our special guest today is Mark Anthony Lewis, a writing tutor at Bristol Community College and School on Wheels of Massachusetts. Mark Anthony received his MA in professional writing from the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He has presented on topics related to speech and rhetoric at Chestnut Hills Harry Potter Academic Conference in past years, including the papers The Case for Rhetoric in Harry Potter and Harry Potter Has a Consent Problem. Welcome to the show, Mark Anthony.
Hey, thanks. How's it going?
Delightful to have you here. We all met at the Chestnut Hill Harry Potter Academic Conference. I remember, Mark Anthony, that I met you in the elevator at the at the Spring Hill Suites. I thought maybe this is a Harry Potter person, and I think I asked you, and you said, and I just remember this. It was the first time this has ever happened to me. You said, "I'm listening to your podcast right now."
Yeah.
How delightful!
Funny. I saw your books, and I was like, "Oh, Harry Potter. Okay, cool." And I recognized your voice, and I was like, "Oh, yeah. I was listening to your podcast on my way here."
Yeah, that's neat. That's so funny. We have enjoyed getting to know each other through that conference. I think that's the kind of thing that provides just a wonderful venue for people to get together. We actually mentioned your paper from this past year about Harry Potter has a consent problem in our Chestnut Hill episode because it definitely left an impression on people. So we'll be talking about that so that our listeners can hear even more about that. So, Mark Anthony, let's just start with the question we normally lead off the discussion with. When did you meet The Boy Who Lived? And how did you realize that Harry Potter was literature worth taking seriously?
Well, I got the first Harry Potter book, Sorcerer's Stone, for my 11th birthday.
Whoa.
Perfect timing. I had a book report due for sixth grade, and I didn't own any books, and my parents didn't own any books, and I was planning on just not doing the book report. And then for my 11th birthday, which is, it's New Year's Eve, same as Voldemort, my neighbors gave me a book for Christmas, and it met the requirements of the book report that I needed to write, and it turned out to be Sorcerer's Stone. That's the first time I read Harry Potter, and I spent all of New Year's Day reading that, and which was kind of a big deal for me because I was not much of a reader. The fact that I actually enjoyed the book was pretty cool. And then it turns out that my grandfather had gotten me Chamber of Secrets a couple of weeks before, and I lost it. I couldn't find it. So it's almost as if fate was trying to tell me to read them in order, which is kind of cool.
That's great.
That is very
perfect
cool.
Time.
You're the only person I've ever talked to who actually got their owl from Hogwarts on their 11th birthday.
Yeah,
I mean,
exactly.
That's basically what happened to you, is that you were invited into the magical world. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Which is pretty cool.
Yeah. And of course, then you are enjoying it. You're being pulled into that world when you are 11, 12. When did you realize that Harry Potter was something that you could turn like a critical lens to?
I don't know that it happened all at once. It was sort of in between the books as they were coming out. I would go on the internet and just read anything I could to sort of feed that obsession. And so I'd go on to MuggleNet and read the editorials on there, and Leaky Cauldron had editorials in their website as well. And I just sort of, my fandom shaped itself around the academic aspects, around finding out what the meanings of characters' names were. I remember I first heard about Joseph Campbell through like those editorials, and about literary alchemy, you know, John Granger's essays and things I found through there. And my fandom sort of developed that way. And I looked out for different blogs, Sword of Gryffindor, or different podcasts like this one, or predecessors to it. And I think a couple of years ago, I wanted to get involved in some way, but I didn't know what I had to contribute. I felt like everything had already been said. And then after finishing grad school, I felt like rhetoric might be a thing that maybe I know a little bit more about than the average person, and maybe I can find a way to bridge those two topics together. And I knew about the Chestnut Hill Conference, and I decided that I was going to present at the Chestnut Hill Conference. And then the first year I didn't, I just went to go watch. And I think that was the year that I met Katie. And then the next year, ended up presenting. And so I've presented twice, and it's fun. I love being a part of this community.
Yeah, me too. I think there's something really amazingly wonderful about being able to talk with people about something that you love, but also bring the academic or analytical dimension into it. And it sounds like you were attracted to those kinds of pieces, even as you were reading as a fan. And then as you became an academic, I think a lot of academics sort of see, hey, like Harry Potter doesn't have to be outside of the academic lens that I'm using in my, you know, in my normal work life. It actually has a lot to offer.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you also have started your own blog. You blog about Harry Potter, but also other topics at your site, Irregardless Magazine, which I love that title. How
great.
Did you get started with your blog, and what kind of ideas do you like to tackle there?
The blog started because I was in grad school and I was interested in advertisement, I guess. I was watching a lot of Mad Men, and I wanted to enter that space in some way. And I figured, I'm a young person, social media is a new thing. I should probably understand how this all works. So I figured a blog was a good way to develop a web presence. And so I blogged about things that I liked, which is just basically things related to literature or writing or linguistics in some way. So, I've got blog posts about pumpernickel bread and oatmeal.
And you do some like word origin things too that I think are a lot of fun.
Yeah, it just completely pointless things that don't matter and obsessing about them. And then I think a couple of years ago, I decided some of the ideas that I wasn't able to fit into presentations, I felt like I could maybe expand on those in blog posts. So I've got a series I'm trying to do where I cover a rhetorical topic in each Harry Potter book. I started that 2 years ago, and it's taken me this long to get close to the end of it, but I'm trying to work through each book.
Well, cool. There are a lot of nice little Harry Potter snippets, nice blog entries that I think that our listeners would be very interested to read more about. And we're going to give little intros to some of those pieces. And I think you are, in fact, doing a really interesting job of bringing rhetorical scholarship to bear on the Harry Potter stories in ways that are actually practical. We can actually think about how is rhetoric happening in our own lives, and the power of words is a major theme of not only the Harry Potter books, but also our podcast. And so that I'm excited. We're going to be talking a lot about the power of words and where we see that in Harry Potter. So let's talk about a very tantalizing paper that you delivered at Chestnut Hill this past year. Harry Potter has a consent problem. Why do you think that there is a consent problem in Harry Potter? This is a lot about the Half-Blood Prince. And you talk about how this reinforces that there's this problem with consent. And what are the possible resolutions?
First, let me say that the title is absolutely a clickbait title.
Advertisement.
Yeah, exactly. I don't necessarily think that the Harry Potter books have a consent problem or that the character Harry Potter has a consent problem, but I do think that the Wizarding world in general does, and I think that that's intentional. It's hard to know whether something an author does is intentional or not, but it's. I think it's there on purpose and it's handled appropriately. We see that a lot of the magic that happens within the Harry Potter books, a lot of the different spells, many of them appear to remove choice or consent from the person the spell is being cast on. So if you look at something like the Bodybind curse or Alohomora, even Alohomora is a way to break into things that clearly don't want to be broken into. The taboo is a way for characters to break away magic spells and essentially stalk someone who mentions you. Inferi are a way to mock the bodies of the deceased. Polyjuice potion is an invasion of privacy. Even the trace, if you look at the trace. I don't want to draw a comparison to like anti-vaccination, but it's this thing that's done to children without the consent of the parents or the child. Maybe it's I'm not sure that's necessarily necessary.
Yeah, it doesn't really exude trust, right? That it's like the rule gets set forward, but the trace is placed on you to kind of enforce your following of the rule. But there's no chance for you to just follow the rule without the trace. I'm just is that the kind of thing you're thinking of in terms of
Yeah.
removal of consent?
Exactly. And it's and you look at it only affects certain wizards. The trace only affects wizards who are come from muggle backgrounds. And it doesn't affect wizards who grow up in wizarding families because it doesn't work because it's a false positive. So it's there's a way there where it sort of affects consent, and it's I don't know whether wizards vote or not, whether that's something that they have a hand in policy making, but yeah, you mentioned that it's that my talk was about Half-Blood Prince in particular, and I think that's where we see that theme brought up throughout the book, the theme of choice and consent and persuasion in general. I think the first Well, as the book opens, we see that the Wizarding World is forcing itself into the Muggle world in many different ways, where Dumbledore is showing up on the steps of the Dursleys, and Harry looks out the window and he notices how odd it is that somebody dressed like Dumbledore would be on 4 Privet Drive. And we see that the Muggle Prime Minister is being visited by the Ministers of Magic, and magic is happening all around Britain. And there's a blurring of the lines between the Muggle world and the Wizarding world.
Like what you're saying is also that the Muggles don't really have don't have a choice about it, right? Voldemort's spells are coming in and affecting them, and then also the Muggle Prime Minister, he doesn't have any ability to say, he tries to actually, kick out Cornelius Fudge, and he's not able to actually do that. And I think you had also mentioned, we've got this scene in Half-Blood Prince. This was one of the ones we thought was so funny in our humor episode, Emily, where Dumbledore is basically forcing beverages on the Dursleys, where they don't, he says, the polite thing to do would be to actually just accept the drink. But there's an element of enforcement that's happening there that is from the wizard world to the Muggle world.
Probably what makes it so funny too. That's part of what is making that so hilarious, is that he really is kind of forcing this on, which is a little disturbing if you think about it.
There's a clear power dynamic there too, where it's, he's a man dressed like a wizard. He clearly does not fear the Dursleys at all, and the Dursleys are clearly in fear of him. They can sort of sense his power, and he's using magic, something that they don't understand, to sort of goad them into drinking the alcohol. And I guess, certainly, yes, the polite thing to do would just be to accept the drink, even if you don't drink it. Just take it. Just pick it up in your hand rather than having it bang against your head. But there's a lot of things that you notice like that once you start to consider, does this person want this thing to be happening to them? Have they consented to this? Are they okay with this?
And of course, that's Harry Potter book six is another book where we see a lot of house elf things going on. I love the house elves. I'm fascinated by them as a kind of character grouping, and they're in 2 and 4 and 6, most importantly. And here they are back in six in the house elves. They're a big part of a consent issue because of their slavery.
Right, yeah, exactly. The house elves are an interesting case because we don't really know how their slavery works, how much of it is willful, and how much of it is brainwashing, and how much of it is a curse put on them as well,
And sort of thinking about, like, are they even able to have a choice? Because of, like you said, some of the brainwashing element that is happening there. Are they able to consent? Is that something that's possible? You also sort of talk in that paper about the Unbreakable Vow, which is an important new spell that we learn about in Book Six that ends up being extremely important with Snape and with Draco Malfoy.
Right. The Unbreakable Vows is really interesting too, because I think when the topic of consent comes up with Half-Blood Prince, the first thing we might jump to is the love potion. The love potion is pretty obviously a date rape drug, right? But the Unbreakable Vow is an interesting thing too, because it's the there's an implication of consent within it. When we see Snape accept the Unbreakable Vow performed by Bellatrix, he has to accept. He has to say, "I will, I will," which is verbalized consent. But it's a forced consent because he's in this situation where he is. It's basically a two-on-one situation where he is below a wizard standing above him with a wand pointed at him. And asking him whether he will perform particular tasks. And we don't really know how that situation would turn out if he were to say no to that. And does that really count as consent if it's under this sort of power dynamic? And we see that again with Ron, when Ron talks about how Fred and George almost tricked him into doing an unbreakable vow when he was a kid. We can see how we can see that power dynamic again, where it's certainly a two-on-one power dynamic.
Which is, this is going on in my house like right now, Mark Anthony. So, a very classic sibling relationship. Yes.
Again, the humor is part, is kind of bound up with how extreme it is. It's like we've all been in situations like, I remember one Halloween, I was dressed as a ghost, and my brother just didn't think my look was good enough. So he put shoe white all over my face, right? When my parents were like not tuned in to what was happening here. So thanks a lot, Chris. It's his birthday today.
Happy
So
birthday.
I don't have face cancer yet, but I mean, like, it's one of those stories. Like, somebody did something, they thought it would be funny. They thought it would be helpful, and it turned out to be like probably super dangerous, and these stakes are so much higher in the wizarding world than they are for muggles. But I
Oh,
think this lack of consent thing is all wrapped up into the kind of extreme expression of human life that the wizarding world is this cipher for,
Right. There's this power that each person has within them that, if unchecked, can be incredibly dangerous. You have it's a basically a willpower where if you will it, if you can imagine it, you can create it, and it shows how dangerous that can be if you're not careful.
Yeah, I think that's really cool. And of course, you in a lot of your pieces, you're emphasizing the power of words and how the wizarding world is very much their power is these spells, where most of the time, I guess you're supposed to be able to cast spells without using words, but most of the time people are using words, and that is that's the source of the power. So it is fundamentally a kind of rhetorical power.
Yeah, totally. There's I mentioned the Greek philosopher Gorgias
Yes.
in my talk, and Gorgias was a is an interesting dude. He's not as famous at his as his contemporaries, Socrates and Plato. I think the most famous thing about him is that Plato wrote one of his dialogues entitled Gorgias, where it's basically a dressing down of everything that Gorgias believes in.
Poor
so
guy.
he's not that famous, but another famous thing about him is his paper that he paper his I don't know what to call it his tablet that he wrote called the Encomium of Helen, which an encomium is a thing that rhetoricians would do, especially back in ancient times, where they would defend something or someone that was not normally defended. So in his case, he defended Helen of Troy, whereas in ancient Greece, Helen of Troy was viewed as someone who was a traitor to the Greek people because she left her husband in Sparta so that she could go be with this Trojan man, and sparked this whole war. And so he wrote this Encomium of Helen, a way of defending Helen. And his defense said that Helen should not necessarily be blamed for leaving her husband in Sparta for this Trojan man, because we wouldn't blame her if she had been stolen by force. We wouldn't blame her if someone had grabbed her and bodily moved her to Troy. So we shouldn't blame her if she had been seduced by sweet words or if she was persuaded through rhetoric. And so he shows that rhetoric has a power of he actually uses the word incantation, to force people to do things. So I guess you could draw that parallel between the magic of Harry Potter and rhetoric in general.
I wrote a piece or published a piece earlier in October about the sacramental power of words. So this whole idea of words themselves having a particular power, is a religious notion as well. This idea that, in the Christian tradition especially, words have this, kind of even dating back to the idea of the way God creates the heavens and the earth through speech. God said, "Let it be, let this, thing come to pass," and then it was, so it seems like the operative power there is speech, the speech of God, and that somehow humans in being made in God's image in the Judeo-Christian tradition, you know, have this same kind of power to some degree, to some extent, and how this was, you know, Harry Potter kind of puts forth this very medieval understanding of that sacramental power of words, that power of words to kind of show forth the power of God in the mundane world. So yeah, I was really interested in that just because of the cross, you know, the intersection that it has with my work in religious studies.
And Emily, I guess one of the things, Mark Anthony, that you talk about is that there are times when even in the magical world, we can see that speech is even more powerful than magic. You know, so magic is a kind of power that's affected through speech. But then sometimes the wizards are just using speeches. And so, you know, where do we see that happening in Harry Potter, for example?
Yeah, I think maybe the most famous example would probably be Dumbledore's Remember Cedric Diggory speech. Mm. It's funny because it's the turning point in the series. It's where Voldemort has returned and Dumbledore has this task where he has to convince the wizarding world that Voldemort is back, and he has to convince the ministry, and he has to convince the people who the ministry are not helping that they have to stay together. There's certain things that they need to do to be able to fight that power that's coming from Voldemort and his followers. And rather than doing some sort of magic to force people to do what he wants them to do, he gives a speech. He gives a speech and he enwraps it within the eulogy of Cedric Diggory. And he tells people to be like Cedric Diggory. Be loyal, be trusting, be kind to one another. And those are the things that are going to help you fight Voldemort, much more than ignoring that he's back, or much more than any sort of combative magic.
And it's a kind of revelio speech. You know, it's, I'm showing you Voldemort is back. And through the, you know, my saying he's back, you know, you can put aside that impulse to deny that he's back, or to say it's a hoax, or, you know, it's not really true. It sort of is putting that idea to rest to say, I have spoken. If I can bring a little Mandalorian stuff in there. Oh my gosh. Great for parenting. but the idea that he, you know, that he's using speech as his major way of persuading people. And as you say, creating a political rhetoric that is persuading people how they should continue to act, or how they should act going forward.
Absolutely. And it's not just his speech, but it's also, he's empowering his listeners by allowing them to build the world that they want to build through trust and through kindness and through loyalty, not through magic, not through stupefy or through Avada Kedavra, but through being kind to people.
Wow. Yeah, he's leading on their relationship with Cedric Diggory, right? Their kind of encounter of somebody like Cedric Diggory. And that kind of forms the basis of the persuasion, is that, you know, you experienced this guy, you know how he was. And now you're being asked to be like that, to fight this evil.
Yeah. There's an American rhetorician named Kenneth Burke, who, he's actually the grandfather of the guy who wrote that song, The Cat's in the Cradle with the Silver Spoon. You know that song?
Sure. Cat Stevens.
He's the grandfather of that guy.
Okay.
Interesting.
And his theory around rhetoric, what he considered rhetoric to be, essentially was, it all forms around identification, was the term he used. And identification is basically a way, when you try to persuade someone, you have to meet in the middle with them somewhere. He says, you persuade a man only insofar as you can talk his language, by speech, gesture, tonality, etc. Identifying your ways with his. The rhetorician may have to change an audience's opinion in one respect, but he can succeed only insofar as he yields to that audience's opinions in other respects. So it's not about me putting my ideas into your head, but about us coming to an agreement in some way and meeting in the middle. And I think that sort of goes along with Dumbledore's brand of rhetoric, where he says that it's about us, not about me, not about a person forcing an idea onto someone else, but about us coming together in agreement.
Wow, that's really cool. And I think there's so much out there now about because we're often so politically polarized and we're just ready for any kind of argument, especially over social media. But that if you want to actually try to be persuasive to somebody instead of just like scoring points, then you do need to identify the parts that you agree on. You know, the things, these are the things that we agree on. And then you can maybe have a chance to move forward in persuasion. So that's very, very much of contemporary relevance.
Just going to bring it around to Harry's persuasion of Slughorn for the memory that he
Ooh,
needed
yeah.
in book six. I mean, that's really kind of the book-long challenge that Harry has to work out. And you know, this theme of persuasion and consent and the power of rhetoric comes into play. You know, Harry has to find the angle, and it's the same angle. It's the angle of the relationship that he had with that Slughorn had with Harry's mother. And as long as he can, as soon as he figures out how to tap into that, you know, first he tries to, I love Harry, ever the Quidditch player. You know, he thinks he's just going to walk into Slughorn's classroom after class and just kind of real quick ask him this, like real quick, like he's going to get that snitch, you know, and it's like, well, that doesn't really work. Actually, you kind of shot yourself in the foot there, buddy. But, you know, but he figures out, yeah, it's that relational angle, and that coming, you know, finding that middle point between where you both are, you know, and for the middle point was Lily, you know, for him to get that memory, but.
Yeah, that's basically Dumbledore's lesson throughout the entire book, Half-Blood Prince. When Ron and Hermione first find out that Dumbledore is going to be giving Harry private lessons, they start speculating about, oh, is he going to teach you defensive magic? Is he going to teach you powerful spells? And Harry's like, I don't know. I don't know what he's going to teach me. And if he finds out that his lessons are actually just information. He's finding out the background about Voldemort, and he's even becoming empathetic towards him in certain ways.
It's the power of
And he's
history. I'll put in my little pitch for history there. We're
there you go.
learning
Yeah,
history and
exactly.
developing empathy. Yeah.
Absolutely. And his like you said, Emily, his homework that he has to do is to get that memory from Slughorn. And that's another lesson there in persuasion and how to persuade Slughorn, because Harry's trying to find ways to force it out of Slughorn by maybe giving him a cheering potion and making him happy, or
Right.
by yeah. And Hermione tells him that's not how it's going to work. If Dumbledore could have just done that himself, if it was just going to be through magic, it's got to be something you can do. It's got to be you have to persuade him. And she uses that word persuade. She says you have to persuade him. And that's what Harry learns. And he gets his first lesson, a little secret lesson, when Dumbledore brings him along to Slughorn vacation home, I guess, whatever you want to call it. And Dumbledore uses Harry as a way to persuade Slughorn to come to Hogwarts. And Harry learns a wet lesson in persuasion there, and then he uses that same sort of persuasion again when he has to get the memory away from Slughorn.
Yeah, that's great. I hadn't really thought about it that way, but yeah, that is Dumbledore's kind of big clue to Harry about it. You know, but then Harry, he's not thinking about that when he is initially approaching his homework. He's not really sure what is the thing that's gonna work there. You know, one of the things that you talked about too, Mark Anthony, was as we were talking about the issue of, you know, lack of choice that is represented throughout book six. And one of those is Harry in that is coming to terms with the prophecy and the fact that he's been prophesied to have this certain destiny related to Voldemort, and and I think a lot of us ACCA fans have also struggled with what does this mean about, you know, the predestination or the free choice that Harry has in this. Bitzer and Vats, who you talk about, who are talking about this issue of there being a context to rhetoric. And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and how that impacts the way we might understand this prophecy that appears to be constraining to Harry. And yet within that, there does appear to be some ability for Harry to make that as a choice.
Oh, sure. So in the 60s, I can't remember what year, Lloyd Bitzer came out with this article where he talked about how we know what rhetoric is, we talk about rhetoric, but we don't know what situation it arises in, and how do we know if we're in a rhetorical situation or not. So he wrote this paper called The Rhetorical Situation, where he describes what the rhetorical situation is. And he says that there are rhetorical situation basically relies on an exigence. The exigence is a problem that arises that needs to be solved, that needs rhetoric in some way to correct that problem. And then you have an audience. And when you have those two things together, a rhetorician can come in and then persuade the audience to solve that exigence, that problem. He makes it sound very much like fate, though, in the same way that Harry thinks of the prophecy as fate, that the prophecy says that I must do this, and so therefore I'm going to have to do this. And Bitzer similarly says that rhetoric can only work when an exigence arises, and then a rhetorician comes in to persuade an audience who is able to make change to that exigence. But a couple of years after Bitzer's article, a man named Richard Batts came out and said, I disagree with that. And he says that you don't need to wait for an exigence to arise to create good rhetoric, because the exigencies are all out there for you to find. And he makes a comparison of Winston Churchill, who was famous for his speeches and his finest hours, that he would come out and he would give this beautiful speech just at the right moment, and he would rouse everyone into action. And the argument he makes is that Winston Churchill didn't wait for finest hours to happen. He went out and he sought those finest hours out. He found things to speak about to convince people to solve those problems. So you don't have to wait for an exigence to arise for you to solve it. You can go out and find exigencies, or you can create exigencies to solve yourself. And I think that's the argument that Dumbledore makes to Harry about the prophecy, is that the prophecy doesn't say that you have to defeat Voldemort, or that your life is going to end either by being killed by Voldemort or by you killing Voldemort. The prophecy is just saying what you are already going to do anyway. It's not a matter of fate, it's a matter of choice. And it's a way of looking at the facts of the matter are the same, but your perspective on the matter is what changes. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just thought that was a really interesting way to look at it, and thinking about it in that rhetorical sense of, you know, because a prophecy, right, that's something somebody said, right? And it's coming into being because, again, it's been spoken into being. And then, you know, does Harry pick that up? And then also, I really like that idea that there's this, you know, there's this whole context. And the question is, you know, how is Harry going to make use of the context in which he's in to achieve what he wants to achieve anyway?
Yeah, there's a nice line from, I think it's the beginning of book six, where Harry is contemplating the situation of the prophecy in his head. And he says, it's the difference between being dragged into the arena or walking into the arena with your head held high. In both cases, you're still going to the arena, You're still fighting. But in one case, you're letting fate tell you what to do. And in the other case, you're deciding what to do regardless of fate.
Yeah, I think that's why that line is so powerful, you know, as we think about it. I think that's one of the ones that definitely sticks with me as well. You know, one of the things that's kind of interesting here is when we look at wizards like versus muggles, and how they think of their own wordy power, their power with words and thence with magic, to define their identity against muggles. and particularly the idea of physical violence that Muggles are using. So how is physical violence in the Muggle fashion characterized at Hogwarts and in other wizard institutions and relationships, really in contrast to that more rhetorical power that wizards have?
There's definitely a divide between, I think, the mind and the body in the wizarding world. I mean, there is in our world as well. But in the wizarding world, I think because when I want to bake a cake, I pick up a bowl and I put batter in the bowl and I mix the batter in my arm, and my arm gets tired because I'm mixing the batter. But with the wizard, they can just cast a spell and have the batter turn itself. They don't necessarily interact with physical objects as much as we do in the Muggle world. If they want to fight someone, they cast a spell, and then that spell hits the person or something like that, like a stupefy or reducta or whatever. Whereas if a person were to do that, they would have to physically go over to that person and put their fist into that person's body. So I think we maybe have a more intimate relationship with physicality and with violence, with physical violence in particular. And I think wizards might have a blind spot when it comes to other acts of violence that aren't necessarily physical. Mm-hmm. They have a blind spot where they may not notice that just because you didn't force yourself onto another person, you didn't physically hurt a person, you can still harm them through spells. And even us in the Muggle world, we can still harm people through words as well. When we're kids, we're told, you know, sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. But I don't think that's true.
Yeah.
I think words can hurt a lot. There's a Godwin's law. You know, however long a chat is going on the internet, it will always come back to Hitler in some way.
Right, right.
But if you think about someone like Hitler, who we blame for the deaths of millions of people, how many people did he actually kill personally, physically? And how many deaths is he responsible for because of his words? I think that's something we need to consider when we think about words, is that words are not just words. Words are sometimes more powerful maybe than physical acts, or they can cause physical acts.
Yeah. And you use the example of when, I guess, is it Harry and George in Quidditch sort of get provoked, and their response is physical violence, like literally just, you know, an attack, a physical attack.
Pummeling.
There we go.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Yep.
That there is something, they just get chewed out by McGonagall. And part of why that is, I mean, there's so much, so many terrible things being done to kids with spells and so on, but it's the fact that they're like punching. I was a Slytherin, am I right?
The
Quidditch pitch. Yeah. And that is seen as beyond the pale.
Right. We see moments of dueling happening in the hallways throughout the series. We see it a few times, and while it's definitely not okay, it's not, it doesn't make someone fly into a rage in the same way that this Muggle dueling is what McGonagall calls it, when Harry and George are trying to fight Draco because
Muggle
he
dueling.
Provoked them.
In her defense, she's also pretty upset when Moody turns Malfoy into a ferret.
Yeah.
She gets pretty bent out of shape about that too, if I'm remembering correctly.
That's true.
Inappropriate transfiguring of a student.
Right. Well,
stepping
there's a
on
physicality
her toes.
To that too. I mean, and mm-hmm. yeah, it's yeah, there's this physical element to it that seems to be particularly disgusting to her.
Yeah. I think it's interesting, the idea that maybe that wizards think of themselves as superior partly because of their, like you said, Mark Anthony, their distance from the physical, and not only physical objects, but physical violence or physical force.
Right.
But that maybe makes them blind to the ways that the things that they're doing are also destructive.
And not just, certainly they're blind to physical violence, but physical communication as well, because there's certainly, we can communicate through words, and there is when we think of rhetoric, usually we think of words, but rhetoric works physically as well. I think I keep thinking of Hagrid in the Care of Magical Creatures course, where Hagrid has this very unique way of being able to communicate with animals and creatures because he speaks their language. Animals don't speak the language that we speak as humans. You can teach a dog to respond to commands, but when a dog wants to tell you something, he doesn't necessarily speak to you. A dog will come over to you and lay her head on your leg or something. She'll lick your hand. A dog will come over, and if you're bothering a dog might snap at you or might bite your hand or something, not hard, but in a slight way, just to tell you to go away. And those are forms of communication too. And I think Hagrid's more in tune to those physical ways of communicating, and that's why he has this gift with animals that other wizards don't necessarily understand.
And, you know, we just had our podcast on werewolves. That's the previous month's podcast. And you make the point that there's, you know, a kind of wizard distrust of magical creatures, and especially ones that have the potential for physical violence. And I think we would maybe certainly put werewolves in that category, and that maybe represents some of the general wizard discomfort with that kind of communication that, as you said, Hagrid is able to bridge.
Yeah, absolutely. It actually makes me think of, I don't know if you've ever read Lady Chatterley's Lover, the D.H. Lawrence
Oh,
book.
yeah.
It's a
Of course.
yeah,
It was a banned book, so of course I had to read it.
exactly. It's, I mean, ultimately the book is remembered probably for being erotic, but underneath that, there's a message of the difference between physical communication, physical intimacy, and intellectual communication, intellectual intimacy.
Right.
It's about, you know, the main character, Constance. She ends up falling out of love with her husband, who she has a purely intellectual relationship with, and ends up falling in love with the gamekeeper. Not unlike Hagrid, who she has not just a physical relationship with, and physical communication with, but intellectual also. And D.H. Lawrence, he's said that was sort of the message he wanted to get at with the book, was drawing, bringing those two things together, the mind and the body, is that if you're purely mind, you're going to maybe demonize the body in ways that aren't necessarily healthy. And if you're purely body, you're going to corrupt the body in ways that, if you were able to bridge the gap between mind and body together, it's a much healthier way to be. And I think that's something that we see that disconnect a little bit in the wizarding world, and I think it's there as well in the real world too.
So one of the things I remember about Lady Chatterley's lover was that he was pretty foul-mouthed. So now that's my segue into the foul-mouth part of
Yes.
of our podcast,
We're good.
Let's do it.
Mark Anthony, you've talked about how certain characters employ magical manipulation and the power of persuasion through a variety of means, and so I want to talk about some of those characters. And the first one that I thought we would talk about is Lockhart. And Lockhart, you see as a very good example of Harry Frankfurt's concept of bullshit. What does Lockhart teach Harry Potter readers about BS? How is it different from lies? And what's the lesson that we can learn from that?
In this
Yeah.
age of BS that we live in.
No kidding.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Lockhart's an interesting dude too. He's so Harry Frankfurt. He's a Princeton University professor, or a professor emeritus. He wrote this essay back in the 1980s about the difference between BS and lies. And that essay, if you want to look it up, is called "On Bullshit." That's it. That's the title. And he he makes a distinction between BS and lies, and that lies are something that you do deliberately when you want to conceal the truth. So if someone is lying, they know what the truth is, and then they try to convince a person that something else is true. But BS is different because it might be a lie, it might not be. It might be true, it might not be, because the actual truth of the matter doesn't actually matter. What matters is the person speaking the BS. And that, I think, encapsulates Gilderoy Lockhart perfectly, because he doesn't really care about the acts that he achieves in the books that he writes. He doesn't care about whether he banished a banshee or whether he hung out with hags or what have you. What he cares about is that you like him. He just wants to be liked, and so he's trying to find ways to get you to like him. And if he needs to make stuff up to make that happen, then sure, okay.
Yeah, and you talk about how that kind of puts him in this in these positions of power in which he's just not able to actually do anything because he's been misrepresenting himself. It's a con job, and then he ends up in these positions where he does take action. Of course, he doesn't necessarily he's not reflective enough to really realize that maybe he's convinced himself that he's capable of doing these things too. And this is what ultimately creates actually tremendous chaos. It's not as though this is a kind of innocent, manipulation of through language, but it can have really terrible consequences.
Yeah, that's a question that I think is interesting to ask yourself when you're dealing with whether it's a person in your own life or people of power. Is BS dangerous? And for the most part, especially when it's obvious, I think we all sort of know someone a little bit like Gilderoy Lockhart, who just is constantly lying about things that they've done, and we all know that they're lying, but we just sort of let it go because they're harmless. And Lockhart seems harmless for the most part, especially after he's been obliterated and he's in St. Mungo's,
Right.
and he's sort of like a little man baby, where it's like, oh, this is sad and a little bit funny, but it's not dangerous. But there is a danger there with someone who is, when that person has power. If a person is powerless, then it's no big deal. But once that person has power, they're sort of corrupting the very idea of logic and reason. They are putting themselves in position. They're giving themselves responsibility that they aren't equipped to handle. So someone like Lockhart, who at the beginning of the books is sort of annoying and funny, at the beginning of Chamber of Secrets, he's sort of annoying and funny. But by the end of Chamber of Secrets, we see how dangerous he is, because people trust him to fight Slytherin's heir. People trust him to save Ginny Weasley. And when Harry and Ron go to meet him in his office, they find out that he's getting ready to run. And that trust that people put into him is a false hope that's incredibly dangerous. And I think that's something that maybe we can see in the real world a little bit too, when if there are people in our own lives who maybe we put trust in to protect us or to save us or to uphold the responsibilities of the leadership that we put them in, and then they fail that trust.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously quite relevant to our day.
Right,
So,
right.
I think it's interesting you actually bring out the notion also that Voldemort does some of this as well. He is being persuasive in ways that may not be exactly lies, but are definitely manipulations to empower himself. And so how would you compare Lockhart's BS with Voldemort's particular brand of that?
Yeah, Voldemort, we might immediately assume him to be a liar, but he's more, BS is probably a more apt term for what he does, because when we think of what makes Voldemort evil, or we think of what Voldemort's motivations are, we think of his motivations are the purity of wizarding kind, right? The rhetoric that he espouses throughout the books is that pureblood wizards are better than muggle-born wizards, or better than half-blood wizards, or better than muggles in general. His defenders are blood purists. The people he surrounds himself with are blood purists. But I think what we learn through Dumbledore's lessons with Harry, when we look into Voldemort's past and we see the young Tom Riddle, we don't really see any ideas of blood purity there. What he's more interested in is immortality. What he's more interested in is running away from death. And I don't really know how those two things became conflated, the blood purity and the quest for immortality. But clearly, the blood purity is not the thing that he's worried about, because he makes exceptions to it all the time. We know that Voldemort was willing to make an exception for Lily Potter. He was willing to not kill her and to tell her to just get out of the way so that he could kill Harry. We know that Voldemort makes exceptions for people like Severus Snape, who seemed to be fairly proud of his half-blood status. We know that Voldemort himself is a half-blood, so he
Right.
makes an exception not only for himself, but he also isn't afraid to tell people that he is half-blood. In the graveyard scene at the end of Goblet of Fire, he tells all of his followers that, oh yeah, this is my muggle father. So he doesn't seem to be that worried about the blood purity thing. The blood purity thing is just a means to an end. It's a way for him to achieve his immortality. It's a way for him to gain followers, and a way for him to get people to do what he wants, so that he can gain power and gain immortality and run away from death. And so in that way, it's narcissistic, in the same way that Gilderoy Lockhart is narcissistic, and in the same way that most BS is narcissistic.
Yeah, I think that's such a great observation, so perceptive that Voldemort is not really his aim is not really where most of his rhetoric is, and that rhetoric is a tool to achieve that immortality. And when you think about Voldemort, I was thinking about this as I was reading your work. He's not even corporeal at the beginning. He's just a voice. He's just speech and persuasion.
Vapermort.
Vapormort. Right.
Yep.
And that he becomes corporeal through the series, but that is again very much focused on him and trying to get things for himself, although his tools of persuasion involve this ideology that he's using to gain and attract followers.
With Voldemort, we also see that he operates in the shadows for most of the series as well. That he doesn't come right out and boldly fight the good guys. He doesn't pull out a sword and chop down enemies in the middle of an arena. He operates in the shadows. He operates in the background, and he influences the way people think, and he influences fears. And as Dumbledore says in his Remember Cedric Diggory speech, he operates through discord.
So I'm thinking back about this. How did this blood purity agenda and his quest for immortality, how did those ever become conflated? And I'm just remembering in book six when Dumbledore is flashing back or showing Harry the memory of his visit with Tom Riddle in the orphanage, I do remember a moment where Tom Riddle makes the assumption that because he's a wizard, he will not die. He says something to the effect of, "It couldn't have been from my mother, the magic. It couldn't have been from my mother because she died." And so there is some association, I think, in his mind. Now, I mean, he has to know going forward that as a half-blood, he is still extremely powerful. And so this can't really, the whole pure blood agenda of, well, we can't weaken our kind with mixing with other, with muggles. So he has to, on some level, know that that's not bearing out for him, that the fact that he's a half-blood doesn't make him less powerful than other wizards. But at the same time, there does seem to be some kind of deep-seated association in his mind between his immortality and his blood and this idea of blood purity. But But again, that would have to be kind of constructed for him much later, you know. And on some level, I think he would have to know and understand that it's really just an ideology, and there's not, you know, some kind of force to it or some kind of, you know, basis for it, you know, in the physical world. But I don't know. Right. That's just a thought. I think there's a paper in there somewhere.
Yeah, I think
we like to do that on this show. We like to throw out for other people to write.
Somebody write that up.
I think that maybe comes back to narcissism as well, because he, like you said, he says, my mother couldn't have been a wizard because she died. Mm-hmm. And so there's, maybe that's where those two things, the immortality and the blood purity, come together, is that his interest in blood purity is his interest in becoming more than man, mm-hmm. and becoming more than, you know, he drops his father's name, not just because his father was a muggle, but because it was an ordinary name. It was a normal name, Tom Riddle. And he adopts this new name, Lord Voldemort, which is romantic in ways. And especially since he takes on the name of royalty, Lord. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be commonly known within the Harry Potter world that there are no such thing as wizarding royalty. So it's almost a sort of like a nouveau riche sort of thing, like, mm-hmm. Like someone who wants to appear rich would wear a top hat and a monocle, and we would laugh at them and say, that's not what a rich person looks like. And so Tom Riddle, someone who wants to appear to be pureblood, takes on the name Lord Voldemort. And I wonder if other purebloods might look at him and laugh and say, like, no, there's no such thing as visiting royalty. You just look silly. It's calling yourself.
But then it also has kind of implications of divinity as well, because of the way the word Lord has been used in the Western world, right?
And making himself more than man, making himself above death.
Right, right.
Wow, cool. Well, one of the other faculty members at Hogwarts that we wanted to talk about in terms of their rhetoric is Snape. And you really see Snape as doing something quite different from these other faculty that we've been talking about. You talk about Snape as a representative of the concept of techne. So what is techne, and what's the power of that kind of rhetoric that Snape uses?
Sure. So techne is an interesting idea too. It's an ancient Greek word, and it's where we get the word technology from. Techne and technology. Techne is the root of the word technology, and essentially, I believe it means art, I guess, in the same way that liberal arts are arts, or in the way that rhetoric is an art, or the way that the dark arts are arts. But it means something more than that. It means something more than simply art. It's sort of a blending of the ideas of art and science, or craft and the fine arts. Craft is probably the most direct English equivalent to the word techne, craft or craftsmanship. And we see that with Severus Snape in his speech in Harry's first year. The speech that Snape gives on the first day of lessons, where he blends those ideas of science and art together. In his speech, he calls potion making, what does he call it? He calls it a subtle science and exact art. So it's not exactly science. It's not exactly art. It's somewhere in between. And I think that encapsulates the concept of techne very aptly. But within the concept of techne, there's also a responsibility within it as well. There's an ethics within it. If we think of techne as being an equivalent of craft or craftsmanship, craftsmanship implies that the craftsman is putting some sort of ethics into what it is that they're making, and there's an ethics of use of what you're going to do with it is that you're making. And I think that correlates really interestingly with Frankenstein, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
Yes.
Yeah. I don't know if either of you have noticed this, but that speech that Snape gives, the exact science and subtle science, or the subtle science and exact art speech, is very similar to a speech that one of Victor Frankenstein's professors gives while he's in university.
Oh yeah,
There's
that's a
the
really amazing parallel there. You have to think
great
that
spot.
that's probably intentional. She's of course read Frankenstein. J.K. Rowling has.
Yeah.
It's the same kind of like vibe too, because I mean, to be honest, Frankenstein is really kind of dabbling in things that are kind of the shady end of science,
Yep.
and Snape is this whole, there's this mystique among the students about Snape that he is this dabbler in the dark arts and that he's been denied the dark arts teaching position because he's not to be trusted. And so he's almost this symbol of the potential of a magical education to steer you in the wrong direction. And so I thought that that was just such a brilliant such a brilliant connection because it's almost like as a writer, sometimes when we're writing fiction, we will just immerse in a particular work because not because we want to copy it so much as that we want to give off the same feel, the same vibe, the same kind of
Yeah.
feeling that you get when you read that. And that's exactly what I thought. I like almost ran to my computer and emailed Beatrice Groves because I felt like it was the kind of spot I'm used to getting from her. And I wondered if she'd thought about that. So B, let us know. Let us know if you're listening. Let us know if you've thought about that.
I haven't had a chance to read Literary Illusions and Harry Potter yet, but
You'd love
I
it.
definitely gotta pick
It's good
that
stuff.
up.
That's good stuff.
I'm not old enough to have read Frankenstein before Harry Potter, but Harry Potter I approached first, and I remember reading Frankenstein for the first time, maybe in college. But it's the second that moment comes up, the very first thing I thought of was the Snape speech, the Potions Master's speech. And I was like, this sounds exactly like Snape. And it's got to be deliberate. I think it's got to be.
Yeah, it does. I think because there's a lot of alchemical content in Frankenstein, and I think she would be deeply interested in that. And particularly, I mean, like it's the forerunner of modern chemistry, right? So what better, I mean, I'm thinking this M. Waldman maybe even shaped the idea of the character of Snape, as the potions master, right? This person who's kind of this alchemical, figure. Oh.
But
So.
if we even think of Snape as like Victor Frankenstein, the notion that he's drawn to power through craft without giving the proper attention to the ethics of what is created from that, and then because of what he's doing, there's all this fallout that actually destroys his relationships in the same way that Victor Frankenstein ends up creating something that destroys his relationships.
In Frankenstein, we see that as soon as Victor creates the creature, immediately after creating the creature and giving it life, he's immediately disgusted by it, and he shuns any responsibility for the creature. He runs away, and then I think he faints. He does a lot of fainting.
He's not well. He's not well for this thing.
No.
It's really a hindrance in solving the problem.
And then and he refuses to be responsible for the creation of the creature, and then he refuses to be responsible for creating a mate for the creature. And up until the very end, up until I think he's on the ship in the Arctic Circle, and he is still refusing to be responsible for this creature that he created. And we see kind of the opposite of that happening with Snape. Whereas with Snape has this interest in the dark arts, that is that word arts again, which is equivalent to the word techne. Snape as a young person has this interest in the dark arts, and we don't know where that interest necessarily comes from. I don't know if maybe he learned it from his mother, maybe he learned it from the possibly negative attitudes he might receive from his Muggle father, but he has this interest in the dark arts and in power, but he doesn't want to take responsibility for what that means. And we see that with his relationship with Lily, is that Lily clearly does not like the dark arts and clearly does not like the sorts of people that Snape hangs around with. And we see in that Snape's worst memory, when Lily finally stops being friends with him, when he calls her a mudblood, he says it just as a way to keep up face in front of the school, I guess. And then immediately afterwards, he goes and apologizes to Lily and says, like, I don't think there's anything wrong with you. I didn't really mean the weight of the word. But he doesn't take responsibility for the weight of what he just said. And it ultimately leads to him losing his only friend that we know of. And it also leads to her death eventually. When we see him again not taking responsibility for his actions, he doesn't take responsibility for the fact that him overhearing the prophecy and then relaying that prophecy to Voldemort resulted in the death of the only woman he's ever loved. And then he doesn't take the responsibility until he turns over to Dumbledore's side, and Dumbledore has that conversation with him and says to him, "You need to start being responsible for your actions. You need to start being responsible for the things that you create and the things that you put out into the world." And we see him accept that responsibility up until his very end.
Wow, I love that reading of Snape. I think that's really powerful way to think about what his trajectory is over the arc of the books. So as we think about the times that we are living in and crisis communication has become something I think that feels like it has immediate relevance. How do we talk to each other? How do we actually communicate what's going on? How do we encourage people to do the right thing in a crisis moment? Even like political communications about crisis, all those kinds of things. What do you think Harry Potter can teach us about that kind of rhetoric, that way of communicating in a time of crisis?
It's interesting. Emily was mentioning earlier how it feels like right now, living in the world, I guess anywhere in the world, it feels like living in Hogwarts under the Inquisitorship of Umbridge. And I hadn't necessarily put those two things together.
I have to give credit to Arthur Harrow. He's a friend of mine, and he posted that meme on my Facebook earlier. So I can't
Nice.
take credit for making that connection, but it's really just about right, right? Every time I turn around, something fun is being abolished.
Yes, exactly. And I'm wondering, like, what is left? What is
Right.
where's my DA? Where's my how
I
do
can't even go to church. They took away
I
church.
I know, yeah, everything.
We need the Weasley twins to just like set fire to everything or something.
Make it all into swamp.
Where's my out? How can I fly
Well,
away?
see, that's funny because you're looking for a magical solution to something that requires togetherness, right?
Oh, all right.
All
And
right,
we see a
think
lot of
about
how not to do things, I think, in the Harry Potter series.
yeah, we see a lot of really bad leaders in the Harry Potter series.
Right.
We see Cornelius Fudge, who is intent on ignoring problems and just hoping they'll go away, just because he wants everybody to be happy and he doesn't want to take responsibility. He wants people to like him, but he doesn't want to take responsibility when he needs to. And then in book six, we see him overtaken by his exact opposite, Rufus Scrimgeour, who might immediately seem to be a good leader, but he's sort of faking it. He's sort of pretending to be a good leader rather than actually being a good leader. He wants to be seen as someone who is who takes strong action against enemies, takes strong action against the crises that are popping up in the wizarding world. But he's just not trustworthy in the same way that someone like Dumbledore or Harry is. I think it sort of comes back to that idea of identification that the American writer Kenneth Burke came up with. This idea that for you to have for you to participate in rhetoric, you have to identify with your audience in certain ways, and there's a meeting, a middle ground that you come to. And I think we see that a lot with Harry, especially in book seven, where his shining moments of persuasion all revolve around people being able to relate to him and people being able to identify with his trauma. We see it with Creature, when Harry has to convince Creature to tell him what happened to the Slytherin's locket. And Harry does it by treating Creature like a person, treating Creature like an equal. And we see it with Griphook,
Oh, yeah.
when Griphook says, "You saved me." And Harry's like, "Yeah, and?" He's like, "Well, I don't think you understand just how odd that is, that a wizard would save a goblin. And I saw you digging a hole
Yeah.
for that elf." And he
Yeah.
says, "Yeah, Davy, what else was I supposed to do?" And we see that Harry's able to convince people to do things that they wouldn't necessarily do because they trust him. And we see that again with Narcissa Malfoy at the end, when Harry comes back from King's Cross, and Voldemort tells Narcissa to go check on Harry and see whether he's alive. And Narcissa leans over Harry, and she knows that he's alive, and she asks him, "Is my son alive?" And I think a lot of people, when they look at that scene, they think of how powerful it is that Harry saved Draco, and that's what saves Harry's life. But I don't necessarily think that's what saved Harry's life. Harry could have saved Draco's life, and then Draco could have died some other way. Harry could have never bumped into Draco at all and had no idea what happened to Draco. Or Harry could have saved Draco's life and told Narcissa Malfoy that he saved Draco's life, and maybe she wouldn't believe him, and she would have outed him right there. I think the magic of that situation is the fact that Narcissa asked Harry, "Is Draco okay?" Harry tells her yes, and Narcissa trusts him. That's where good leaders come from. I think that's where someone who can deal with a crisis situation in a positive way is someone who is trustworthy and can identify with their audience, and they can convince people to do things that they wouldn't necessarily be apt to do because we trust their judgment.
And I think too that if you look at the in book seven, especially when the ministry's been taken over by Death Eaters and Dolores Umbridge, she's got Mad-Eye Moody's eye on her wall. That's, I think, an illustration of the surveillance culture. And we're, of course, seeing that surveillance also being used in the pandemic times. I think that's one of the things that's been going on in China. And I think there's been some question of the degree to which that'll happen in the United States as well, and that there, there's surveillance, there are all the pamphlets that they put out, how to, what is it, how to, and they've got the 10 most wanted, or I'm sure it's not 10 most wanted, but it's they've got most wanted wizards, and there's there they are really stoking the fear and also the surveillance, and this is a time in which there's a tightening up, there's a demonization of a group of people. Who are then to be controlled or rendered powerless, and that these are things that J.K. Rowling is saying not to do.
And they don't help.
And they
That's
don't help.
the and I think we're seeing a lot of that right now. I can't remember which country it was, but I think that there's a country right now who's trying to use cell phone data to track coronavirus patients, to track where they have been. So that they can reach out to people, anyone who they may have been in contact with. They're using social media, they're using GPS tracking, they're using CCTV to track where people have been before, and to find out what they've been doing. And that sort of right now it sounds okay because we want to protect ourselves from coronavirus, but something I'm afraid of a little bit is what's going to happen after this pandemic is over. And is that going to go away? These are things that are, it's sort of like the relaxing of the unforgivable curses, in Harry Potter, where how corrupt are we going to become in our quest to fight this evil?
I did just a quick Google on that, and it's Israel that is using the cell phones to track that.
Oh, it's like the trace.
And once again, we've kind of circled back around to issues of consent and choice.
And the difference between people who are doing it right and people who aren't doing it right. I think a lot of this is a little bit, it's very similar to how Rufus Scrimgeour handles the Voldemort situation, where he wants to appear to be doing something. This was pretty funny to find. He literally uses the words "exciting things are happening" when he's talking to Harry at the Weasley's house.
Oh my.
He says when he's trying to get Harry to come to the ministry, just show up and have some pictures taken at the ministry. He says, "We want to give people a sense of hope. We want to give people a sense that exciting things are happening," and our president used those words recently, a few weeks ago, before anything was really happening.
Oh my.
He used
Exciting
the
things are
phrase,
happening, like the spread of a virus.
"Yeah." It's like, "Oh, this virus will be gone." I think he said, like, "This will be gone soon. Exciting things are happening right now." And we now know that exciting things weren't happening. Nothing was happening. In the same way that nothing was happening under Scrimgeour's ministry. But we also see some countries that are doing it the right way, and some countries that don't need to resort to sort of the draconian ways of containing the virus. I think South Korea seems to be doing it pretty well, and they're doing it through information and through knowledge and through a shared togetherness and not through force. I think we're seeing that in Singapore as well. So yeah, there's definitely a parallel there between how the wizards are dealing with crisis situations and how we in the real world right now are dealing with crisis situations.
And I think this brings up, questions about the times when rhetoric is failing, and when the rhetoric doesn't work. And Harry actually tells Rufus Scrimgeour, "I'm not going to be your little PR tool to convey a message that I actually don't agree with, and I don't trust you." But that there are these moments in the series where speech and rhetoric are not successful. And I think about, for example, this just to go to the big one at the end when Voldemort is trying to call followers and it doesn't work.
I honestly, not to hate on her, but when I think of failed rhetoric, I keep coming back to spew, to SBEW.
Oh, right. Absolutely. I agree with
It's
that.
obviously a very important cause. It's obviously a very positive cause, but it's not working. And I think as people right now anyway, we don't want to ever admit when our rhetoric isn't working. We don't want to admit when our persuasion isn't working. We want to blame the audience. We want to say, if you ever get in an argument with a loved one, we'll say, "Oh, well, you need to just understand me better." And we don't want to admit that maybe my communication is failing and maybe I need to adjust my communication and find a better way to persuade you. That's one of those things that I think of when I think of failed rhetoric.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like a failed relationship, in the sense that Hermione doesn't really have, she has this kind of cerebral understanding of what's happening with the house elves, but she hasn't really talked in depth with one about their experience,
Yeah,
until
exactly.
the book seven, when she is, they kind of are able to, she, Ron, and Hermione are able to kind of meet in the middle because Creature kind of tells this whole story and she understands more, but then she can also persuade Harry and Ron a little bit better because, she gets to that point where she's screaming, "Can't you see how sick it is the way they've got to obey?" And then they've got this example, this relational example of what she's been saying all along. And so I think it's a powerful moment for all of them.
And Creature is able to show her the complexity of his relationship with his master as well. Whereas probably before that, she would only see it as sick and disgusting. But when Creature is able to show that he cares about his master in a way that he cares about Regulus Black in a way that it's sort of the unfortunateness of the situation is that we don't know whether it's actual love or whether it's just brainwashing. But there's certainly we know that there's definitely a complexity there, and Hermione's able to see that complexity and able to relate that complexity to Harry and Ron, and to get them to come over to her side.
Well, we've talked a lot about the power of words and speech in this episode. So just as our kind of final thought, as I look at our time here, we've had such a nice conversation. Mark Anthony, what do you think we can take from Harry Potter about how words can be magical for us in the Muggle world as we look to apply these lessons to our own lives?
I guess it comes back to the, I always think of the sticks and stones argument and how wrong that is, and how sticks and stones can break my bones, but words will never hurt me. Words are just as powerful as actions, and words lead to actions, particularly rhetoric. That's basically the definition of what rhetoric is words that lead to action. So if we can think of, we might fantasize about being able to cast a spell, to be able to say a few words and to make things happen by saying those words. And my argument would be that we can do that. And that's what rhetoric is. Rhetoric is that exact magic that allows us to imagine a thing in our heads, to verbalize that thing, and then to create action that leads to that thing. I think that it comes back to the very thesis of this podcast, that through imagination, we can create realities through that.
Well said.
I was going to say, that has to be the last part. That's beautifully said. That's such a nice encapsulation of everything that we work for here and at the podcast in general, but also particularly in this episode. Well, thank you so much, Mark Anthony Lewis, for being on the podcast today as we investigate
thank
the power
much.
Of words. What a delightful conversation. Emily, thanks to you for being my co-host.
Thanks. And no, you're very welcome. And I the other thing I could have said, instead of well said, I could have just yelled, bullshit. I had to tamp down
no.
that. Even though I don't think it's bullshit, I still had to tamp down that instinct. Just because we've
sure
already
there
let
are people
that cat
saying
out of the bag.
No. We crossed a line today.
It's exactly not BS, is that it's
that's right.
We might think of it that way, we might think of it as BS, but it's real, and it's real if we make it real
in our heads and real reality.
Yes, precisely.
Well, somebody who really helps us to make this real but not too real is our wonderful technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. Thank you, Emma, for making us sound, no, really just as good as we really are.
Thanks.
And it's for helping our words to reflect our reality as best as we can. So we always appreciate you, Emma. Thank you. And as always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. And Lori Beckoff, our MuggleNet liaison and producer. Thank you, Lori. Dear listeners, we are also so glad that you joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Please share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. And now I will leave you with the very appropriate wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Words are, in my not-so-humble opinion, our most inexhaustible source of magic, capable of both inflicting injury and remedying it." We'll see you next time when we'll be using our words to make some magic.